With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Bro History. It's Henry Zamota, and I'm joined with my friend Jose Nino. What's up, Jose?
Nothing much, Henry. Thank you so much for having me on again. It's always a pleasure chatting with you.
Yeah, no problem, man. I appreciate it. Danny Abdeljabbar is he's traveling right now. He's actually in Europe, and I actually got a funny... I got a message from Citizens App saying that if you're in Europe, be careful. for protests. And I was like, well, Danny's in Europe, but Danny can blend in to the protest given his last name. Yeah. So I'm sure he's all right. But what's up, man? How is everything?
Oh, I've just been quite busy doing writing for various sites and also my Substack, the usual grind. I've gotten some new gigs and I've really liked some of the pivots that I've made in terms of content. I'm still doing international relations content, but I'd say I'm doing a lot more of it now, and I generally enjoy that more than talking about domestic politics for the most part.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to speak with you, because there's not that many people who have like a good holistic knowledge of what's going on in the world in terms of geopolitics. And I think you're really, really good at that. Like, that's something you're really strong at. Like, understanding how, you know, what happens in one country is going to impact something that's going to happen in another country, or how it's going to impact, like, U.S. domestic politics. And you're really good at putting that all together, which is really rare. And it's exactly why I wanted to speak to you about the current, you know, the current situation, obviously, in Israel and Gaza. Just to date this, just because who knows what could happen between, I mean, even before this podcast is done. It is October 19th at 8:18. In about an hour, Joe Biden's going to address the nation, which I suspect he's just going to be like, we have unequivocal support for Israel. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that he's going to make some remarks about like how Israel is like the only democracy in the Middle East, and that our support's going to be steadfast for it in this trying time. And I think he might just announce also like how they're going to deploy a lot of military aid and to stave off any potential attacks by militant groups ranging from obviously Hamas to Hezbollah. I don't think that it's going to lead to any direct escalation for the time being, but who knows, because there's just so many moving parts right now, and there's a lot of things that we have not been made aware of or that is probably still in the gray zone. And with that in mind, I think it behooves us to just sort through these facts and then see what happens, because we are at a very volatile geopolitical moment, so anything can pop off.
I don't think that this is going to extend outside of Gaza. I don't think it will. I think it certainly can, though, and I can certainly be wrong. I think for the most part, like, the goal is going to be to contain this in the Gaza Strip, and Hezbollah, I think, will put pressure on Israel. There's going to be some weird things that happens with some of the militias in Iraq. They're probably going to send things like drones to air bases and things that will most likely be shot down. You know, earlier today, there was apparently the Houthis sent some drones up the Red Sea. Yeah. And then there was a couple Iraqi, some of the Shia militias had sent some drones to a base, but nothing was harmed. They were shot down immediately. But it shows you, like, there's these little games being played where you know, the Iran-backed groups, and I say that loosely when I say the Houthis, but more so like Hezbollah and the Iraqi groups. I think they're going to do some things really just to say, hey, we're here, but I don't think that they're going to really invade Israel. Like, yeah, that would just blow everything out of proportion. Like, I feel like that would be highly unlikely.
That's my opinion as well.
Especially when it comes to Lebanon, because that's what you're hearing, I guess, what the big concern is, and that's what I'm reading why the Israelis aren't going into Gaza, because they're scared of fighting a two-front war. So, you know, the threat is that if they go into Gaza, then Hezbollah is going to invade from the north. And that's probably why the aircraft carriers are there, to just say, you know, just as a preventive measure. But Lebanon's having so many problems. Like, they have such a bad financial crisis right now. And, you know, they're any kind of like ethnic fight can erupt as a civil war in Lebanon. That's how they always started, you know, like ethnic fights in different towns that kind of spread into overall war. But I just don't see it. I hope it doesn't, because it would just be horrible.
Yeah, likewise. I don't think much is going to happen, even with respect to the military operation in Gaza, because I think like a direct, like, urban warfare operation that Israel would conduct would be just a, like, quagmire waiting to happen. They're just going to, the IDF will just incur some pretty significant losses. And it's just going to, it's going to be a lose-lose, because I think that that kind of like crackdown of it, there's like a lot of collateral damage. Israel's Arab normalization projects might be just on pause for now, and some may even reverse a bit, because the fact is we now live in the era of alternative and social media, so Israel cannot get away with a lot of its geopolitical machinations like it could before in the legacy media era. And there is much more pressure now on Arab states to not really go full normalization route, or much less like forge a public military alliance with Israel. And so it's definitely factoring all of that in, is not taking it lightly, because it is at a very sensitive moment in its history. Because prior to this, Israel was in a state of like a cold civil war between the ascendant ethno-religious elements of its society beginning to flex their political muscles and the Ashkenazi like secular elite that have dominated Israeli politics since its founding. And I just think all these factors, both domestic and foreign policy-wise, could fundamentally alter the political structure of Israel. And I actually am of the opinion that that Israeli state will not look the same in a few decades due to changing demographics and just like the realities of like multipolarity, where it can no longer throw its weight around like it could with like the U.S.'s full backing.
Well, what do you think it could look like?
I think that it could turn into, honestly, a quasi-failed state, especially if all these like settler types and other really like religious fanatic Israelis take control of nearly all structures of government, from like the military to like the legislative bodies. Because these people, they're going to very likely staff them with like cronies, are much more fanatic, and I'd argue they're also much less competent. So you're going to see like a wholesale deterioration of governing practices and even like infrastructure. And then and not to mention like these really just brutal crackdowns against Palestinians that I think will turn into like really nasty miscalculations on a geopolitical scale that will turn into like a pariah state both in the Middle East and abroad. I just think that its future does not look that great when you factor in that, and then also the ultra orthodox, which end up being on the public dole more often than not, and they're exploding in terms of population. Like Israel, in many respects, there's a good case to be made that it might not make it in one piece by its centennial in 2048, and things aren't looking that good. Even prior to this Gaza attack, as I mentioned before, there looked like there was like a coup being hatched by the elements of like the Israeli deep state against the Netanyahu coalition.
When you look at the situation in Gaza, and it's one of the reasons why I think they're in a state of paralysis, where they're saying that they're about to invade, but so far there hasn't really been that big of a sign. All the support, though, from the West, from America, it seems like they have the green light, and that's what they're expecting. They're expecting an invasion into Gaza, so maybe that will happen. But in Israel's position, they're kind of in a situation where every single option is bad, because, you know, option one is to invade Gaza and end up in a quagmire. You end up killing however many people. I think there's about 3,000 dead already in Gaza. You know, as cold as it is to say, when Israel has these conflicts with Gaza, there's like a body count. There's like a body limit that they can't really go past before the international community starts to say, all right, settle down now. Usually that number's been around the 2,000 mark, where the international community jumps in. It's like, all right, too many people are dying. This is going to cause like the Arab and the Muslim world to explode if this keeps on going on. Let's rail this in, and then, you know, Hamas won't be totally destroyed. It will, you know, they'll just take out maybe, I don't know how many they'll take out. It won't be enough for them to neutralize the threat forever. And, you know, the saga continues. In their position, you know, if they go into Gaza, they'll take casualties, which
big
they
time.
Don't want to take. And if they don't go into Gaza, then, I mean, it's going to be bad politically that they just had this terrorist attack. I mean, the terror attack was absolutely horrendous. Like, let's just be completely serious. It was like, you know, ISIS level head chopper, crazy, insane. It was like a Genghis Khan type raid. And for them not to be able to react to that is just like a really, really, you know, it makes them seem like they're in a big position of weakness. A lot of the press and a lot of the mainstream press, and I'm seeing it from Israeli press, I'm seeing it from a lot of press from Europe, from England, is urging Israel not to go in because they're going to enter in a quagmire, that this is an accident waiting to happen, that, you know, it's going to be, first of all, a hard military operation, and second of all, it's going to really just destroy any type of normalization with other Arab countries, or at the very least put it at a halt or a hiatus until things
that's what
start
I think.
To norm- I mean, it will take years. You know, this is not something that would be resolved. There'd have to be a significant amount of memory loss before they started negotiating again, and then a good amount of bribery to go along with that. But, you know, it's a tough situation because, you know, ideally, there's no, in a perfect world, you would say, okay, what Israel needs to do is resolve the conflict with the Palestinians. But that's another thing. There's just no realistic option of how that would happen.
Yeah. One of the more interesting things that struck out to me was that there was no rally around the flag effect that this terrorist attack created, like, say, like 9/11. Like, Netanyahu's government is being put on blast. Like,
oh,
politically,
dude, yeah, it's terrible. Haaretz is tearing him apart. There was an article from Jerusalem Post. I think it was, or was it Times of Israel? It was, you know, one of the more center newspapers in Israel, saying that he created Hamas. You know, this is his blowback.
Blowback, yeah.
Putting it on his shoulders.
Yeah. Yeah, Israelis are not exempt from that. Yeah, I think that, like, basically, like, in many respects, this is a sign that Israeli state is not as powerful or cohesive as people think it's going to be. And it's going to get worse, as I mentioned before, with this new form of factionalism that's emerging now as, like, the ethno-religious right gets a lot stronger. Because, like, these type of people, to put it bluntly, are, like, brutes. They don't really have the same kind of...
tact, savviness.
Tact and savviness that, say, like, the original, like, Zionist, like, founders of Israel had, like, the more, like, secular types. They didn't have, like, the same type of, like, statecraft and, like, ability to conduct, like, basic, like, governing functions on a daily basis. I think the introduction of this element, especially with Itamar Ben-Gvir, even though he's out of the picture for now, I think it's just a sign of, like, just a lot of, like, crazy tensions that are going to emerge. And, like, not just, like, domestically. I think even some of the stuff they do with the Palestinians, too, could really destroy Israel's rep with these type of people gaining power. Because, I do think that, like, for example, like, the idea of, like, a two-state solution is largely, like, not even talked about anymore. And especially with Israel just becoming, like, even more, like, hard right due to, like, the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox element becoming even stronger in Israeli politics. It's a bad situation all around. And let's not even get started with regard to the U.S. too. If there's a deterioration of the U.S.'s economy, and with the fact that it's going to be doing, like, a dual containment of Russia and China, Israel just simply won't be able to count on the U.S. as its, like, most, like, reliable ally. Like, a lot of these factors are probably being considered now by the present Israeli ruling classes now that they're realizing that, like, yeah, Israel's days of being, like, an expansionist, like, irredentist type of regional power that wants to create, like, a greater Israel are, like, over. Like, now they're going to have to go back to basics to make sure that they get a lot of domestic stuff sorted out and somehow handle the issue of Palestine in a much more rational way. Because I think the more they push this, I do believe that this will result in, like, some type of fragmentation of the Israeli state in the next few decades, because there's just so many powder kegs in that country waiting to happen.
Yeah, man. It was just, like, ever since Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated, it's just been, like, slowly creeping up, and this is the end result. And, you know, it's not like Yitzhak Rabin was promising the moon to the Palestinians. Like, they were promising them, they were, you know, if the Oslo went through, it would have been a state within a state type thing, you know, like, it wouldn't have been, you know, its own nation state, but it would have had some level of sovereignty, and it would have been a lot better than the situation now. At this point, with the settlement issue, it's just a two-state solution. It's just the only way that you could do it is if you would expel the Jewish settlers there. So you'd have to essentially, I guess, I don't know, you can even say it, ethnic cleanse your own demographic or your own population. You'd have to remove them from there. And that's not going to happen. Like, I don't see that happening unless there's just, like, a really big flip politically where they, you know, swing more to the center somehow. If, you know, if this is kind of like their moment where, okay, these guys in Likud have taken our country to the brink of destruction. And my friends who are more on the Zionist side, who are not just like your standard, you know, Conink, everything that Israel does is holy and great, but they're like realistic Zionists. They're like, man, if I was in control of the government, I would tell those settlers to leave. Like that would be the first thing, is to bring those settlers back, say, here's your state, and then close the borders. And then that's it. And then, you know, issue resolved. Obviously, it's a lot more complicated than that, but that would be the start. But on the flip side, it's, you know, if they continue to, they can't kill their way out of this, you know?
No, they can't.
There's too many people. They can't kill enough people, even if they killed 100,000 people in Gaza, which is they're not going to do. Like they would, that would just be so outrageous that there would, you know, be it just wouldn't be able conceivable. That's still what 10% of the population of Gaza, or 5%. There's 2 million people.
Yeah.
So it just seems very hopeless. Like, I was like thinking the other day, and like, what is the realistic solution to this? Like, how do you solve the Palestinian problem with it in Israel? Like, how do you integrate them into the Arab world so they can have partnerships? And I was like, is there like a massive reparations project you could do? Like, could you literally just pay off the Palestinians one by one and give them reparations, and then ask them to move politely but forcibly to some other country? Like, is that the only way?
Oh, that is actually, I know a good deal of Israelis, like, that are not just like Likudniks, but part of the Israeli right, that's actually a pretty mainstream position among certain elements of like the fringe Israeli right, to just pay off like Palestinians to move to Arab countries. Forget his name, that one guy that was part of like the like Israel's like libertarian party, like Zahut or whatever, Moshe Fagan advocated for that, and that's actually a pretty common policy proposal among certain Israeli right-wing parties. But like, there's like, it's becoming like a freak show on the Israeli right, though, because of the settler element. That's that has a life of its own. And even if you talk to your average like Likudnik, they even will tell you that, like, yeah, like that's like a problem they want to go away, but it just won't, because these guys, they're really adamant, and they're becoming like pretty well organized too, as seen with the rise of Itamar Ben-Gvir.
Prodigies of Meir Kahani, who
was
very, very, very far to the right. Like the other day, I was like, this is Ben-Gvir's idol, and I sent him the book, and it's just titled, you know, one of his books was just called "They Must Go."
Yeah,
they must go.
That's the mindset of a lot.
What do you think that book's about? They must go. Yeah. And I was like looking at the reviews of it on Amazon, and it's just like great points. It was like 5 stars, like a real profit. It's tragic, man. Like, I really don't wish any harm on, you know, I criticize Israel's policy a lot, but I don't wish any harm in anyone there, and I feel real bad for the people who have to suffer through just all this craziness. I mean, I know some people who I don't know anyone directly, but I know people who've had family killed there. It's terrible. But it's like, you know, they created, I was talking to Danny about this last week, and the Zionist Project has created a state where it's the least safe to be a Jew. Like, there's nowhere more dangerous for a Jew than Israel. Yeah.
No question.
Unironically, it's sad. And, you know, I guess with the state of Israel, it's when it was created, you can certainly understand the motivation to create a state, like to have like a state, you know, a powerful state fight on behalf of your group to work in the interest of your group. And you can certainly understand the motivation given, you know, the history of the late 19th and 20th century. And I could certainly understand why American Jews supported it so much. I think there was a lot of fear from American Jews in the 40s and 50s that, you know, since a lot of them were communist or, you know, a lot of them were sympathetic to the Soviet Union, that there could be a crackdown on them when during like the 50s and the beginning stage of the Cold War. They thought the state could come after them. So I can understand like the motivation of like having this state as not only a refuge, but as like a powerful entity to fight on your behalf. But it's just, the state of Israel was created in the time of ethnic cleansing, and not just like, you know, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians where, you know, there's 700,000 of them were clearly, like, it's not even historically debated. And Israel is just common knowledge. Like, any Israeli historian will say, like, yeah, they were ethnically cleansed. But they were cleansed in that, I guess, during the time where that was just completely normal for that decade. You know, how many Germans were cleansed from Czechoslovakia and Poland after the war? 16 million. So that seemed like a minor ethnic cleansing compared to the context of what was going on in Europe. But the state just never changed. Like, it's like a early 20th century state living in the post-Nuremberg world.
Yeah,
and
very accurate.
Now liberals in the U.S., you know, they're still complete support for Israel due to lobby efforts, but those lobby efforts really are creating an artificial support. I don't see, and like you mentioned earlier, that you're not seeing the rally behind the flag moment. I'm not seeing it either. Like, if you read about like the 70s and during the 73 war, and you know, there was a million Jews marching in Brooklyn. Like, if there was an attack on Israel, you know, there'd be Israeli flags and there'd be marches everywhere and there'd really be a strong rally around the flag effect. You're not seeing that much. You're seeing way more Palestinian movements, and not only in Europe, but in the U.S. as well.
Yep. I was at a pro-Palestinian vigil yesterday at UT, and it was quite large, actually. One of the more shocking stats I saw, I don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head, but even like evangelicals under 40, they're starting to not be like that pro-Zionist either. And that's actually scary if you're an Israel firster, because that's the primary demographic they're going to lean on to like now, because the GOP is right now like Israel's best friend politically in the U.S. because the Democrat Party, because of its like changes over the last few decades, it's become very like lukewarm, if not like outright hostile towards Israel lately, especially. And that's going to grow if the Israeli government takes a much stronger ethno-religious character. And I agree with you that really Israel in many respects is starting to resemble like an interwar period, like authoritarian country, especially now with those judicial reforms that the Netanyahuites are trying to implement. It just looks like another like ethno-nationalist state, like say like in the Baltics or like in like Romania in like the 1930s or whatever. It's nowhere like, does it like resemble like some like woke liberal state like in Europe or like the US or the broader Anglosphere, which is actually like really hilarious when you think about it, that like the US and its satrapies in NATO will continue to give like this increasingly ethno-religious state more military aid and diplomatic cover.
Israel and Ukraine. And Ukraine is just another, like...
Oh, yeah.
like, this super duper... Like, they just contradict, like, all the values that supposedly that the you know, the Western bloc of the world stands for. But it's just... I think that's one of the reasons why... And I'll take this back a little bit. Comparing this with the war in Ukraine, I call the war in Ukraine now the liberal jihad, because that really was a holy war for liberal Democrat types in the U.S. and I guess people on the center left in Europe as well. A complete holy war against what they saw as like a mean guy,
yeah,
really. I mean, obviously, there's more to it, yeah. but this is not taking the same... It's not grabbing the same hearts and minds, and it's somewhat surprising. But I think I've been saying this for the past couple of years, where it certainly seemed that the liberal, like the center left part of this country, has been trying to not look at Israel because they know, they kind of know what's going on there, and they're frankly embarrassed by the settler issue and the increasing recognition that it's an apartheid state. You can see this in the human rights reports that have came out. You know, Ben Salem, the Israeli Human Rights Organization, and then Human Rights Watch, both in 2021, they both came out with large studies. You know, the one from Human Rights Watch is a 200-page study, and basically just goes case by case why Israel's an apartheid state. And this is Human Rights Watch. This is not some fringe.
Yeah.
You know, crazy Marxist leftist professor. This is like a very mainstream organization. A lot of times Human Rights Watch is used to stir up war propaganda for things that aren't necessarily true. But in this case, you know, they wrote this paper and or this study. And you have to think about the donors of Human Rights Watch. A lot of them are Jewish. A lot of them are liberal Jews. So I think in the long run, with Israel, how it depends on its diaspora for support. Like, it's always going to depend on a strong diaspora in the United States. As Jews in this country get older, they're going to lose that connection to the, you know, to World War II and the Holocaust and you know, a lot of the atrocities that were committed against Jews. Because they won't have they're no longer going to have family who experienced that, so they won't have those firsthand accounts. And I think if that trend continues, you'll see more apathy from American Jews towards Israel, which you know, it, frankly, Israel depends on you know, a motivated diaspora.
Yeah, and this also highlights too some of like these desperate, in my opinion, anti-Semitism laws that Ron DeSantis' government in Florida has been like passing with regards to like Holocaust studies or whatever, or like the dissemination of so-called anti-Semitic propaganda, which really is mostly like a legislation to clamp down any like critiques of Israel. Like, this kind of stuff is like clear. It's clear that there's like a there is desperation among the Israel First crowd to try to use legislative means to shut down anybody who dares to question like the prevailing narratives surrounding Israel. Like, literally, Israel's like most like fervent support now is like extremely online Indians, and to some extent the Modi government, but that's more nuanced because of the fact that the Modi government is generally anti-terrorism for the most part. But I think even then that support might be limited, because if that body count gets really high, India may end up taking more of a neutral stance, because India has historically been pro-Palestinian, or at least like neutral, or at worst neutral on the matter.
I imagine a lot of those pro, you know, Israel accounts ran by Indians are more or less just anti-Muslim accounts.
Yeah, it is like a proxy. It is like the Hindutva movement. Actually, I read an article from on the Cradle where they argued like that Hindutva movement has some interesting Zionist influences and some very creepy connections to Zionism as well. But yeah, there is like a broader, like it is seen as like among like Hindu nationalists, like an anti-Muslim type of conflict. But I also think another element too with regards to U.S. Christians, these like Itamar Ben-Gavir types gaining power, they're going to be also engaging in some really unhinged and uncalibrated forms of anti-Christian iconoclasm, like in places like Jerusalem and whatnot. And because of alternative media, man, like that stuff is not going to be hidden any longer. And you might start seeing some people in the U.S., like some right-wing Christians, sour on Israel as well. Like, the younger generations of like even Republicans are not as Zionist as their boomer parents.
Yeah. Have you seen the poll where they break down support for Israel or sympathy Israel regarding the Palestinian. I think everyone's seen it where it's 80%. Boomers are pretty much 80% leaning towards Israel, and then Gen Z is like 80% the opposite way, where it's they're 80% towards Palestine, which is kind of shocking. I'm surprised it's so low from the Gen Z generation.
Yeah, I think there's something you mentioned, Henry, like the legacy of World War II, for a lot of people, that's like ancient history. They can't really relate to it. And even the Cold War, for that matter, because even Republicans have been forced to really adapt their message to like the new realities of like 21st century U.S. politics, because you can't always be appealing to the World War II nor the Cold War to rally people. Like, you have to talk about like salient issues of our time, and Israel, seriously, like the defense of Israel is just not one of them. Like, that's just the new reality of American politics in the for the rest of the 21st century. Yeah, I just think that time is not on Israel's side unless, like, there's some visionary leader that is able to recognize, like, some to recognize that Israel has to make several reforms to stay as like a functional political entity. It's just it's going down a very chaotic path, and it's largely a downstream effect of like the multipolar cultural geopolitical environment that's been emerging over the last decade or so, because a lot of countries that were now very much like beneficiaries of U.S. hegemony, they're going to have to really retool their domestic and foreign policies as a result of a more competitive geopolitical ecosystem.
How exactly does multipolarity come into play here?
Yes, I think that you're going to see more pressure now from countries like China and Russia to on Israel to like reconsider some of its policies and even bolster some of its rivals. Like, Russia and Iran's defense cooperation is tightening, and that's also the case with China and Iran as well in the economic and defense spheres. Like, a stronger Iran is something that will put a check on any potential Israeli expansion in the region. And I just think that the more competitive things become, and the fact that the U.S. cannot dedicate as many resources to the Middle East, it's going to compel Israeli policymakers to reconsider a lot of controversial policies and think twice. Like, for example, the Gaza invasion, both from like a Israel from the potential loss of Israeli and Palestinian life, and how it could also have a really nasty effect abroad, because Israel has made a point trying to like normalize relations with not just like the Arab world, but even parts of Africa and the broader global South. And if they're just seen just brutishly beating up Palestinians and massacring them, whatever diplomatic gains they've made over the last decade, they'll just evaporate.
It always comes down to like, how can they settle this? Like, how can they settle this issue? Like, can they, is it within the realm of possibility for there to be some type of settlement? And again, like, it's just, I think people who have been following and have dedicated their lives to the Israeli-Palestine conflict, most of them are just like, I've tried everything. There's nothing that will work. This is going to be going on until either the end of times, or, you know, the problems solved in a very violent way, or, you know, all the Israelis leave. Like, that's usually the take. And it is quite gloomy, to say the least. Because you're just going to see more of this. You're going to see more of these horrible attacks, and nobody wants that.
Yeah, I don't see really any solutions coming from the current crop of Israeli leaders, and I'm not sure what's going to happen. That's why I'm not very bullish about the future of Israel. to be honest.
Well, I mean, it's going to take someone. You need like a U.S. president to sort this out.
Yeah, and even then,
there really hasn't been there hasn't really been a president since George Bush Sr. That's really, well, I guess Clinton too with the Oslo Accords, but more so like Bush. He's the one who kind of got the ball rolling with that, where, you know, after the Iraq War, he was, you know, he basically said, all right, the time is right now where we can try to solve this issue. And according to him, he blames, you know, George Bush Sr. blamed the Israel lobby for him not getting reelected. But I mean, this current administration, I don't feel confident that they have any type of answer to this.
Yes, I think foreign policy elites in the U.S. Really can't be trusted. And I think they've become, their quality has degraded significantly in the last few decades. So there's just not many options from the U.S. either, which is why I just think that chaos awaits like Israel. It's pretty much baked into the cake because there aren't that many rational diplomats being produced these days in the U.S. And when you look at, say, like the so-called like restrained and realist populist right, they're just like Zionists, but with better cosmetics. Like, with the exception of like Thomas Massie, you really don't see many good policymakers in the Republican Party that offer like any sensible, non-interventionist, like realist responses to what's going on in Israel. And on the Democrat side, there's still a lot of like liberal Zionist capture, but it is becoming more or less chilly towards Israel. But I'm not sure if like the people that end up the new generation of Democrat leaders will offer much of a constructive alternative. They might just be filled with a lot of invective, but not much in terms of solutions being offered.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Yeah, well, I don't really have confidence in them either. You know, I was when Blinken was first hired, nominated to be Secretary of State. I don't know. I felt a little bit like, you know what? He's experienced. I think he might be a kind of a realist. In some regard, he might just be in there to cover Joe Biden's flank, and that's to not get into any foreign policy messes while he concentrates on his domestic policy. I didn't have that negative a feeling towards him, but man, I was talking to you know, Matt O, who was, you know, worked in the State Department, and he met Blinken, and he basically said that he's flat out incompetent. Like, he's just not a competent person, and he said he's just not an impressive, knowledgeable guy. This guy went to, I mean, he's a great guitar player. Yeah. He's a great guitar player. I mean, I think that's probably what is his true calling. I'm pretty sure he has many talents, but he goes to Israel and he goes to the Middle East, and he says he's going to have these meetings with these Arab governments to try to resolve the solution, but he says he's going there as a Jew. And I'm like, why would you say that? Like, why would you say that going into these countries and then painting yourself on the Israeli side 100% as part of like I'm negotiating on behalf of them. Like, you need to go in there like an even broker. And there's no wonder that these governments just didn't show up to the meetings.
Yeah.
I think the Saudi delegate didn't meet, or the Saudi ambassador didn't even meet with them. And then in Jordan, they said it was too unsafe for them to even come in the state. I mean, it's just, it's crazy. It's pretty embarrassing.
I think even al-Sisi in Egypt kind of like threw some passive aggressive shots at Blinken too. I think he said something to the effect that, like, yeah, Egypt has never like oppressed Jews and all this, because he was like taking Blinken's remarks as if like they were like accusing Egypt of partaking in anti-Jewish policies. But that guy's always struck me, following his moves, is very incompetent. And I don't think it's like unique to Blinken. I think it's like actually a feature of a lot of like diplomatic corps. Like, even like in the Trump administration, you had people like John Bolton and like Mike Pompeo. These people were like far cries from the likes of like Henry Kissinger, say what you want about him, or like Dean Rusk, or other people that were embedded in like the U.S. diplomatic corps, like throughout the Cold War. Like, those people were all like on a like different astral plane than these lightweights that we have these days.
Yeah, I think Ronald Reagan was actually right when he said that if business steal, like, government doesn't have the best mind because business steals them, something along those lines.
Yeah, but, that's actually pretty.
I think he's right with that. You don't get the brightest in these, like, a lot of them are just suck ups, you know, like they're just career kiss ass suck ups. And, you know, they get far because they, you know, out of some type of nepotism or whatever, but it doesn't seem like anyone is competent.
Yeah. That's what I'm starting to guess as well. I do think that's like a sign also of like very much like civilizational, like institutional decline, because once you go to like straight up cronyism just to have like a functioning state, that does not augur well for its long-term stability whatsoever.
It's in that, like you said before, it's not like if Trump's elected, he's going to bring in some like foreign policy squad to fix these issues. The sad thing is his instinct is probably better than anyone he would hire.
Yeah.
Unless he brings back McGregor.
Yeah.
Like his instinct to work with, to, you know, pull troops out of Afghanistan and to, you know, get on friendly, to start building a peace with North Korea, to remove troops from Syria. I mean, those were all his instincts. And, you know, there were obviously people like, I think Flynn and Bannon were whispering in his ear, and obviously those guys are not perfect at all, and they're not great, but they certainly seemed to be more realistic about foreign policy than other people he brought in.
I think Bannon, even right now, he's actually taken like kind of a very like hands-off approach to the Israel thing. He's like a Zionist, but he's not as enthusiastic from what I've seen about it compared to other right-wing influencers these days, because, man, it's just, like, awful just going on right-wing Twitter, like, hearing all the takes.
A lot of them are genocidal.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't mean that to be, like, I'm not trying to be hyperbolic. Like, a lot of them are literally, like, you need to erase this population from the earth.
Yeah, I was like that one Breitbart staffer, Joel Pollack, that, like, was basically calling for ethnic cleansing in a post, and everybody like screenshotted it and everything like that. And then like he walked it back like a few days later. Lord.
You got to hear the things that Ben Shapiro is saying.
Oh, that's like almost like is to be expected. Like, that's like nothing less, man. I did like though that one clip going around of Shapiro where he was saying, like, I think this was like circa 2014 or whatever, like a decade ago, where he was like saying, oh, like Israel's fine, it can take care of itself. And then like fast forward to the president, he's like saying this, like, if US doesn't give it military aid, we're gonna be looking at Israel potentially using nukes. Like, Lord.
Yeah, like a threat.
Oh yeah, Mark Levin did that same thing the other day, which was even creepier too. Like when he was like on Fox, like, oh my god, these conservative like Zionist influencers, they're a special case of like unhinged creatures that really should not be given so much attention, but unfortunately they have like hordes of people that like gobble up what they have to say.
Well, the thing about the American right is that basically every single institution is on the side of the center left. You know, all the institutional support, all the big donations are going to the Democratic candidates. So the right, the only really big institution of power that they have on their side, they have like three. They have energy. Yep. They have the MIC, and then they have the Israel lobby. They need that. They don't have like, you know, BlackRock. I mean, I'm sure BlackRock does fund. I don't look at all their campaign contributions, but by and large, corporate America is on the center left. Yep. DNC. And like that's their only—I mean, that's only one of their only institutions of power that they have. Yeah. And now that I think, you know, the attitudes are changing so drastically, I think the Israel lobby will probably go all in on the GOP. Yeah,
I think so too. I actually think has kind of united a lot of the GOP's like factions, because you're seeing from the populist right to the typical like neocon Israel first right, they're sharing a lot of the same talking points. Some guys in the populist right will say, oh, we shouldn't send like troops, but like do send like military aid and stuff. But like it's largely been pro-Israel across the board. It's I think it's gonna be once the Gen Z and some younger millennials come of political age and start taking power, that's when you might start seeing some interesting things happen to the GOP. But for now, I do think they're firmly on the Israeli side, with the exception of like Thomas Massey, who's a lone wolf. There's just not much like in terms of dissent among Republicans on that issue.
Now we're back to Bush era talking points, where you're hearing the word Islamofascism. Yep. And you know, honestly, the war on terror has been turned on a lot of Trump supporters, America First type people. Maybe some of them see this as an opportunity to shift the war of terror from themselves back on the original target, which was Muslims. Another big takeaway from this is that you're going to see a shift in policy from the Ukraine war.
Oh, yeah.
And that's like the other big thing that's coming out of here, is that now this is like really the perfect opportunity to slowly back away from all the aid. And you see that in Jack Kirby, the spokesman for Pentagon.
Oh yeah, he was
saying that.
Oh yeah, that was when I heard that, once that shoe dropped, you know there's like a pivot going now.
I don't know what their plan is for Ukraine. I know that I've been reading stuff about how they're diverting ammunition from Ukraine to Israel, which I'm sure they are. I'm not sure how this war ends, but it certainly seems that they're going to end on Russian terms.
Yeah.
And I honestly wouldn't be surprised if there's just... when the moment gets really, really dark and the Ukrainians feel like the U.S. has finally truly abandoned them, that they're going to, they'll flip and just say, all right, we'll flip to the Russian, like, we'll become friendly with Russia. Like, I can certainly see it, or aspects of it will flip. Because, I mean, Ukraine is a multicultural society as well, where... you know, you still have like pure Russian speakers who don't even speak Ukrainian in the Ukrainian armed forces. So I can see something like that happening, where they, you know, there's enough people who are like, let's just cut our losses and
yeah, they might go multi-vector, to be honest.
Yeah.
I could see that definitely. I mean, that was like Ukraine. That was like pre Orange Revolution. What Ukrainian politics kind of looked like then. It might go back to like a status quo ante in a way. They may actually Ukraine may go more of the pro China route too, because they had pretty warm relations with China prior to the Russo-Ukrainian conflict. And to be honest, China is starting to be seen in some international relations circles as like the most stable geopolitical entity, because they're not the ones funding all these crazy proxy wars or prosecuting these quixotic military ventures abroad that just end in so much suffering. And that's going to be like and with China helping normalize like ties between Saudi Arabia and Iran, it's going to look a lot more appealing now than the increasingly erratic U.S. and its pitiful satrapies in Europe.
Do you think that if there is ever a state that negotiates a truce, or not a truce, but a solution to the Palestinian issue, do you think that it would be China?
I'd say it'd probably be the most likely, to be honest, because they don't really have a lot of emotional stake in it. I mean, China engages with all Middle Eastern actors, and they do have an anti-terrorism streak too with the Uyghur situation, especially when you look at the fact that like the Uyghurs are like part of that transnational. A lot of factions within the Uyghur movement are part of like that transnational Sunni jihadist network that has been largely propped up by the Anglo-American Zionist axis. So China could potentially be a mediator in that respect to calm both sides down. And actually, some polls show that a lot of Israelis do view China very positively. And even like that former Mossad director, I forget his name, even said like openly said that, yeah, this whole China-U.S. Geopolitical conflict, this is something that Israel should have no part of. I think it was like Yossi Cohen or somebody like that. But yeah, I could really you could see China try to break this form of geopolitical stagnation and position itself accordingly. But it's got a lot of issues of its own, and I don't know. A lot of these type of geopolitical conflicts, a mediator like China has to gain something out from it. They're just not going to do it out of like the kindness of their heart.
You know, in Israel, they operate the port of Haifa. I don't know what their exact motivation came from with Iran and Saudi, like, you know, brokering the détente between those two nations. But I mean, that's like a huge step to solidifying yourself as like a broker of peace, because I mean, essentially that kind of closed the loop on the war in Yemen in a sense, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I know it was more complicated than just like the proxy war, but it's interesting to see their role growing.
Yes. Yeah. I know Chinese and Saudi relations go back to even the Cold War, and they've had pretty positive relations for the most part. And yeah, and even like when with respect to the Yemeni conflict, I think that the Chinese did give like tacit support to Saudi Arabia in terms of maintaining some degree of territorial integrity in Yemen. But I think the Chinese, they're smart in terms of like knowing that like the U.S. is giving the whole like global South, like the emerging powers in the global South, like an instruction manual of like what not to do abroad in terms of projecting power and everything like that. So they definitely are exercising a lot of restraint when it comes to foreign policy that's outside their traditional sphere of influence.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Yeah, the U.S. is certainly led by example of what not to do. And like, why would they want the head? Why would they want the headache? I mean, China has so many internal problems. And the thing about China that most people don't get is that it's China as a unified state has like, you know, it's not usually the norm. You know, typically, it's like very cyclical when it's unified. A lot of times it's divided up between warlords or different kingdoms, and they certainly don't want to do anything to rupture the state. You know, they have their own demographic problems and, you know, a lot of self-made problems. I just don't see them, you know, in regards to Taiwan. But most likely, if that issue is solved, it's probably going to be solved peacefully. It's going to be solved with probably approach the Kuomintang taking power in Taiwan and, you know, signing some type of deal with Beijing.
Yeah, that's what I think so too. I also think too, if like the U.S. just grows incredibly unstable and it starts like losing both clout domestically and abroad, there are elements of the Kuomintang and also the Taiwanese military elites and economic elites that have been impressed by mainland China's economic growth. And funny enough, if you look at the way that the CCP has structured the Chinese economy, it does have some eerie similarities to Chiang Kai-shek's economic model for Taiwan when he was in power. So there, it is very conceivable that the Taiwan question is handled peacefully if the Kuomintang retakes control there. And a lot of other shoes drop, like say, like a loss of U.S. prestige, because at some point, the U.S., if it doesn't get its stuff sorted out, like it's going to lose some prestige on the world stage, and people, other countries are not going to be as keen to follow its model as religiously as before.
Do you think that there's already been a break in that where countries are starting to look to other ants, like, you know, to look for other partners, or do you think there are some specific examples of countries that have clearly lost respect for the United States?
I mean, you have like the formation of, I think it's largely like a lot of hype, but like BRICS and like the expansion of that, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization as well, like the rise of that prominence, And I think there's also starting to be like growing like anti-American, a resurgence of that, of anti-American sentiment to abroad. It's really going to be, you're probably going to see this happen more in authoritarian countries abroad that have had a lot of Western NGOs trying to stir things up, where that shoe will drop. And then it could start spreading to parts of even Europe. At one point, I think Emmanuel Macron in France was condemning a lot of Black Lives Matter related type of demonstrations and even like intellectual movements surfacing in French academia as like American, as like an American type of style, like infiltration that has nothing to do with like the problems that France is facing or has any like historical basis whatsoever with French, like the French political scene. And to me, it will ultimately take, I think, some right-wing populist governments to start taking power, like in Europe, to see that really happen. They're actually like more American skeptic, not like the Meloni government in Italy, which has been like a very loyal satrapy of the U.S. thus far.
Something that I really wanted to get your take on was this, because you had said this to me in a text that you thought that there, you know, with one of the reasons why the U.S. was hesitant about Israel invading Gaza was, you know, that Hezbollah has a lot more power than just in the Middle East, that they're, you know, they have global networks. And I know that they have, there's like Hezbollah in Latin America. You know, you being from Venezuela and knowing the region, do you know anything about that? Like, what is Hezbollah's reach in South America?
Yeah, in South America, there are significant Lebanese, Syrian, and even Palestinian diasporas there. They're not Muslims. Most of them tend to be Arab Christians, but they're pretty sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. When I was in Chile, which is I lived there for 2 years. It's like the has the largest Palestinian population outside of the Middle East, or one of the largest, definitely in the top three. You routinely saw huge pro-Palestinian demonstrations, but with respect to Hezbollah, they're very likely in the countries that have a presence, in countries that have these diasporas where they can kind of blend in, and especially Venezuela, which is an ally, a strong ally of Syria and Iran. In fact, Venezuela is a large Syrian diaspora to boot, and there's even been several members of like the Venezuelan National Assembly that fought in the Syrian civil war on the side of the Assad government.
So you think that what Hezbollah has, like, just like sympathizers in South America, or more so like actual like cells in South America?
They might have like a good deal of sympathizers and even some cells. They could cause some damage there. I mean, you had like those attacks like in Buenos Aires that were like attributed to Iran and Hezbollah. But there's like some evidence that it might not be so clear, but on paper they could have like some cells activated there. And I wouldn't put it past like Iran and them to do that, because Iran tends to respond very asymmetrically to the U.S. And what better way to poke it in the eye by stirring up trouble in the Western Hemisphere? Because like now the U.S. is dealing with all of its maneuvers abroad. It's not just dealing with like non-state blowback. It's starting to deal with like great power or emerging power blowback, which is a different animal altogether.
Do you think that someone can come across the border the southern border with the intent to cause problems, whether that be, you know, I mean, use your imagination of what kind of problems someone could cause with sympathies to Iran.
Yeah, perhaps. I tend to think it might happen more in like an ally of the U.S. in Latin America more so than happening on American soil. Because I think like U.S. like border security, at least from like counterterrorism standpoint, has generally beefed up since 9/11, and also like other traditional routes of entry into the U.S. I think it's gonna be a lot harder to do that. I think it's more likely that you could see American assets targeted in Latin American countries, which have very sketchy defense architectures and counterterrorism measures, for that to happen.
Like, there was the Colombian police, they stopped. There was like an assassination attempt on like an Israeli ambassador or something like that. Man, I gotta read the
yeah. Colombia is crawling with Mossad spooks.
Oh yeah. Well, did you hear about how the Israeli ambassador and was thrown out of they got into a big fight with the Colombian ambassador, or with the Colombian representative? I don't know who he got into a fight with. I didn't read the whole article, obviously.
Yeah,
but it ended up being like a hissy fit fight where they started calling each other Nazis.
Yeah, I saw something like that. Yeah, Gustavo Petro, the current president of Colombia, he's an interesting figure. He's definitely exercising all options on the world stage, and he is starting to become a thorn in the side of a lot of like the right wing elements of like the Latin American, like international affairs, like lobby.
Who's in the right wing international affair lobby? Like, who does that represent?
Oh, people like Marco Rubio.
Okay.
Yeah, people like him. There's a guy, I forget what, I think he was associated with the American Enterprise Institute, Roger Noriega. He's like really plugged in to the Latin American like right-wing think tank network, and he's been a constant booster of like these like absolutely crappy neoliberal right-wing governments that the U.S. props up. And those guys are also huge Zionists. Like, you go scratch any Latin American right-winger that's like based in Miami all the way down to Buenos Aires, and you have like a freaking Zionist there. Like, even that eccentric Argentinian presidential candidate, Javier Milei, is a big time Zionist, despite his very interesting like economic proposals, such as like abolishing Argentina's central bank.
How about the president of El Salvador, Bukele?
So he had that tweet the other day where he denounced Hamas, but is actually kind of ambiguous.
I mean, that's pretty easy to announce Hamas. Yeah. Like, no one is celebrating the terrorist attack in Israel, besides really French people.
But I saw a Times of I think it was a Times of Israel or a Jerusalem Post article where this was like a few years ago where where they said like he was like a friend of Israel, but he hasn't really gone public on the issue. And interestingly, he did have a meeting with Saifedean Ammous, and Saifedean Ammous is the author of the Bitcoin Standard. He's a Palestinian Jordanian that is very anti-Zionist. And he is pretty good friends with Bukele. So I'm not sure if he's had an impact on Bukele's views on the Israel matter. But I did hear one guy from this one right-wing think tank. His name is Joseph Humeyer, Center for a Secure Society or something like that. It's a pretty right wing, like hawkish think tank, where he expressed some misgivings about Bukele because of some connections his family had to certain Iranian businesses. But like, that's like the most I've seen, I've heard about Bukele, and it's very speculative.
Yeah, because he's like, whenever you hear the mainstream press and the U.S. talk about him, it's always like, oh, Latin America is getting a fascism problem, and this is the guy who's starting it.
Yeah, he's very heterodox for sure. He doesn't resemble, like, he has like some similarities to what's it called, like several like right-wing dictators that the U.S. government has propped up in the past. But he's also willing to stir the pot on certain issues that will anger elements of the U.S. Deep state, too.
Like, I just typed in Bukele in Google, and the first thing that pops up is Amnesty International. President Bukele engulfs the country in a human rights crisis after 3 years in government.
Yeah. The NGO network absolutely hates him, for sure.
And I know he's just like, he just represents authoritarianism. Is that the reason why? I don't know why certain networks hate him so much.
Yeah, he's just like an authoritarian that largely opposes many of the holy sacraments of the Washington foreign policy elites. He's a big law and order guy. Funny enough, he's a millennial too. And he is in many respects kind of like an MBS of like Latin America, in that he is willing to use some like really oftentimes like ham-fisted authoritarian measures to get his way. And he's an interesting figure to watch. Actually, he was also pretty neutral about Russia's invasion of Ukraine too. He's on a geopolitical level, he will be kind of curious to see what he does with respect to China as well, because China has had a growing degree of influence across Latin America.
Yeah, man. Even a lot of conservative types, like Tucker Carlson had a special on it, and I was like, man, this is dumb. I mean, how true is that? Like, how is that like a negative thing? Like, what's your opinion on China's growing influence in Latin America?
I think it's kind of like natural, to be honest. In terms of economic affairs, I don't think it's that much of a threat in that respect. I think that if it does like set up a military presence in Latin America, I think it's just a product of the U.S. overstepping its geopolitical boundaries, to be honest. But I just think a lot of it's like overhyped.
Yeah, me too, man. I think it's just like, I don't know, what's the big deal? It's not like they're putting, you know, boots on the grounds here or anything like that. But I just realized that we're over an hour and 20 minutes. Time really flew by on this podcast. So I'm going to wrap it up right here. But before we close this, let everyone know, because I listen to your podcast, El Nino Speaks. I really do enjoy it. And I read your stuff when it comes out and follow you on Twitter, of course. Let everyone know where to find your work.
Yeah, you can find my podcast on Substack, my Substack, Jose Nino Unfiltered. The podcast is El Nino Speaks. You can find it there. You can also download it on iTunes and Spotify. And my Substack is josbcf.substack.com. And then you can follow me on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Jose Al Nino. Those are like the best places.
Nice.
To check out my work.
Nice. And I will have the links in the description. Jose, thanks so much, man, for joining.
Take care.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.